we have Harry Whalen. He's an MD, the Blesser Family Endowed Chair in Neurology at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. He is a professor of pediatric neurology and director of the Hyperbaric of Wisconsin unit. He's professor of neurology. Oh, sorry, guys. Losing my place. He is at the medical college there, and he has been inducted into the NASA Space Technology Hall of Fame for his research into the use of near-infrared LEDs for wound healing and the treatment of brain tumors and neurofibromatosis. In a multi-year investigation approved by the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Whalen is studying the use of LEDs to promote healing of mucositis from chemotherapy and radiation used to treat cancer in children. Dr. Whalen found that diabetic skin ulcers and other wounds in mice healed much faster when exposed to the special LEDs in the lab. Near-infrared light stimulates improved energy metabolism in the mitochondria, leading to treatment for mitochondrial diseases, which affect the brain, eye, heart, and muscle. Dr. Whalen is also funded by the National Institutes of Health in a study of neurodegenerative disease, traumatic brain injury, and other childhood traumas. He also is conducting a pilot study supported in part by the Clinical Translational Science Institute of Near-Infrared Light Therapy for Diabetic Macular Edema, a form of diabetic eye disease. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, better known as DARPA, is funding his research in neurological ischemia, traumatic brain injury, reperfusion, and stroke, which affects many children with congenital heart disease. Dr. Whalen presented this translational bench-to-bedside research to the United States Congress at the NASA spin-off day on Capitol Hill as an example of how space research is helping patients. Dr. Whalen holds the rank of captain and is a diving medical officer in the U.S. Navy. He is a consultant to the Navy Experimental Diving Unit and serves as the senior undersea medical officer for the Deep Submarine Unit. With clinical and research experience in hyperbaric medicine, wound care, and combat casualty care. I'm getting out of breath here, guys. He has over 80 publications, including Cancer, Laser, Light Emitting Diode, and Diving and Hyperbaric Studies. Let me tell you, check out the link that is on healthfreedomrights.com in my announcements, and you can read all about his publications as well. Welcome to the show, Harry. It is a pleasure to have you. I'm so glad you could join us.
Thanks, Robin. It's good to talk to you.
So, you know, I always wonder where a good place to start with would be, and perhaps you could explain to our audience a bit about mitochondrial function and just how the light actually, you know, feeds the cellular response to enhance our energy.
Well, every cell in the body has a little engine, and it's called the mitochondria. And the drivetrain of that little engine is a series of chemicals hooked together in what's called the electron transport chain, and these chemicals are called cytochromes, which is Greek for cell color. So it's not surprising that light therapy might be valuable if you target chemicals in the body that have already been known to absorb light and are even named for that. But previous to recent studies on light therapy, there wasn't that much attention to it. There have been some sporadic reports for many years about light therapy, but no real good scientific assessment of the basic molecular mechanisms until recently. So the fourth step in this drivetrain of cytochromes hooked together in what's called the electron transport chain is called cytochrome oxidase, and it happens to absorb light in the far red or infrared range that's just at the border of what you can see. These are longer wavelengths, so they penetrate deeper into body tissues, which has a therapeutic benefit as well, because it doesn't matter what light does if you can't get it to the parts of the body that need to receive the treatment. But there are still things that have to be overcome technically in order to get it really deep into the body, but certainly for skin and mucous membranes and into the eyes and some other areas, it's already fairly accessible. And there are some areas of hope for therapeutic benefits at various stages of clinical trials. The idea of what the mitochondria do is sort of a similarity in a concept to back in the old days before we had nuclear submarines, we had diesel electric submarines which would run on their battery charge when they were underwater, just powering an electric motor, but on surface they would use the oxygen in the air through a snorkel to charge up the battery by running the diesel engine. And that's kind of like what the mitochondria does. It uses the food you eat in order to generate power by electrically transferring chemical reactions from the food through this cytochrome process, which is kind of like a waterfall cascade. Imagine each step is kind of like the next step in a water wheel, you know, with water flowing down from one step to the next, gaining energy each step of the way, with the electrons producing a charge inside the mitochondria, kind of like charging the battery would be in a diesel electric submarine, and then the charge is produced in formation of a molecule called ATP. So when you decide to blink your eyes or move your hand or think a thought, you're not really burning lunch. You're using up molecules of ATP that were charged up in the mitochondria, just like, you know, the battery gets charged when you're running a submarine on the surface and running the diesel engine. That's how it works. So now what the light does is, being absorbed by the cytochrome oxidase, we believe it alters the shape of the molecule in such a way that it becomes more efficient at transferring electrons. And the photons of light are absorbed by the molecule, and then they produce electron transfer within this large, complicated molecule, which is a big protein that has copper atoms in it, which absorb the light, transfer electrons through to the iron atom part of it, which is where you bind the oxygen to burn the food and charge the battery. So if you can make that more efficient, you can charge the battery better. And also, when there's not enough oxygen to go around, as in the case of strokes or heart attacks or traumatic brain injury or other acute injuries where there's temporarily a loss of oxygen or a loss of blood flow, also like in an asphyxiated baby, many of these things where there's a temporary loss of blood flow or oxygen, then these areas that are supposed to bind oxygen in this molecule of cytochrome oxidase might bind something else instead, like nitric oxide. That happens to be a molecule that we've proven is involved in some of what the light does when it shines on the cytochrome oxidase molecule. And if the nitric oxide can be knocked out of there, the oxygen can go back to doing what it's supposed to do, which is charging the battery. Otherwise, the oxygen floats around in the cell and causes trouble, which is called oxidative stress, and burns the cell to death. So in an acute injury where there's a sudden loss of oxygen or blood flow, when you restore the oxygen, it actually makes as much trouble as the lack of oxygen did before, and that's called ischemia reperfusion injury. And we've been able to demonstrate with the light that if you use the light at the point in the reperfusion or reflowing of blood back into the damaged area, you can decrease the reperfusion injury where the oxygen returns and put it back to the task of making a battery charge through the production of ATP instead of burning the cell to death through oxidative stress. And we can, in the case of heart attacks and strokes, we can reduce the size of a heart attack or a stroke in animal experiments by half if you use the infrared light right at the reperfusion beginning point, where you restore blood flow. In the case of these experiments, after a half hour without blood flow, if you use the light for just 3 minutes in the period where you reperfuse or restore the blood flow, the size of the stroke or the heart attack is reduced by half. And if you use chemicals that block the transfer or knocking out of nitric oxide from this iron binding site that's supposed to normally process oxygen, if you block that benefit, you can actually remove the benefit of the light therapy, which proves that this nitric oxide thing is important. And nitric oxide is a well-studied molecule in a lot of oxidative stress medical problems. And when it is knocked out of the spot where it shouldn't be, so the oxygen can go back where it should be, the nitric oxide plugs up leaks in the mitochondria so that it doesn't fill up and explode or, like, sink, like restoring the bilge pump in a boat or a ship, so that it doesn't fill up and then collapse into dysfunction. So that's what we know. We've actually purified pure cytochrome oxidase in our research lab, and I have a biochemist working with me named Brendan Quirk, and Dr. Quirk is now actually studying the specific changes in the shape of the cytochrome oxidase molecule that's produced by the light energy to determine exactly how this all is done, so that we can be even more efficient in improving the benefits of this light therapy for patients.
Very exciting.
We're using it for different things. Right now we're getting ready to try it on some eye diseases because it's easy to get light in the eye. And we've already tried to prevent mucous membrane damage in cancer patients that can result from chemotherapy called mucositis, and various wound healing skin problems that have been studied by a lot of people over the years, but never clearly proven to be of benefit in a double-blind, multi-center controlled clinical trial.
So far, yeah. Just fascinating. You have the best explanation I have ever heard.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Well, I mean, you lay it out so clearly. It's so easy to follow, and so many in the audience have been looking forward to hearing you on the show again, and I get so many questions and responses from the audience about, you know, I can kind of follow and I get what they're talking about, but I would love to understand so much of this on a more basic level, and you just did a beautiful job with that.
Thanks.
So, yeah, just that's wonderful, and I can see the parallel, the tie-in with underwater rescue, with the hyperbaric oxygen chamber to help reoxygenate those areas that have been deprived. So I'm curious, what came first for you? First neurology, and then was it mitochondrial diseases?
I was definitely interested in understanding the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Before I ever thought about mitochondria, I was interested in understanding the mitochondria after I realized how important the energy processes of the brain were in its functioning. So I guess I would say neurology came first. One of the things that might be of interest someday would be to find out if possible to enhance or improve the functioning of the brain by increasing the energy in each brain cell. So at this point, we don't know that, but we have some evidence in our research lab growing brain cells that demonstrates you can even take normal brain cells that haven't been injured in any way and improve the efficiency of the energy process, the cytochrome oxidase molecule function, a little teeny bit above normal. So I don't know if it's possible to say that that might constitute performance enhancement that might be of some clinical usefulness. We don't know.
Well,
we'll just have to see.
From some of your other published peer-reviewed papers, the reports when I started on this whole journey about light-emitting diode technology and then starting to understand a bit more about mitochondrial function, you know, like 101, it just was so dramatic to hear about the increases by using the certain wavelength of the light-emitting diode. I believe it's a 630 to 680 nanometer frequency.
Uh-huh.
And that could stimulate and increase the production of adenosine triphosphate. So what I have found and the reports back from patients, observations with animals, that increase of circulation is so dramatic for decreasing the time it takes to heal, for muscle pain, inflammation. I mean, just so many unexpected things when you do good clinical observations that, you know, are secondary to what you might be trying to achieve. And it seems like the future lies right there with healing with light.
Yeah, I would agree with that. There are a lot of things we still don't know about it, and there are a lot of things we still haven't solved about it that I would like to prove upon. One example is the depth of penetration of the light. At this point, I'm still not satisfied with how deep we're sure that it can go. We know that in using light as a diagnostic tool, you can actually get through the skull. Everybody who's ever had, you know, a family member or a friend in the hospital with anything serious has probably seen those little pulse oximeter things they put on the finger.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And what it does is it uses the same wavelength of near-infrared light to follow closely how much oxygen is being transported in the blood, because the hemoglobin, which is the red chemical that's supposed to carry oxygen, has a different spectrum or color red absorption when it's got oxygen and it's carrying the oxygen compared to when it does not. So oxyhemoglobin and deoxyhemoglobin have a different spectrum. And the degree to which the redness is absorbed from the near-infrared light-emitting diode can tell you how much oxygen is being carried. So that's been done for many years in the finger, and so already you know the light can get through at least the distance of a finger, or it wouldn't be able to do that. But
sure.
Now people have started doing that with the surface of the brain, and they found they can do this exact same thing. And in the brain, when they put something like a pulse ox over your skull, they call it near-infrared spectroscopy, but it's really the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the value of knowing this is clearly, if it's possible to do near-infrared spectroscopy with this wavelength of light, it must most definitely be possible to do therapy with these same wavelengths of light because we can get it in there. And so it's a well-accepted thing. If you go to an intensive care unit now in a what we call a tertiary care hospital, a large major medical center,
mm-hmm.
And you look at the patients, you'll see these near-infrared spectroscopy patches oftentimes on their scalp. It looks kind of like a Band-Aid, except it's got light-emitting diodes and photosensors. So it's already an FDA-approved, routinely used technology that's able to get light into the surface of the brain. So I think a lot of the groundwork has been done demonstrating that near-infrared light has the potential to get into the head. So now the question is, can we prove that using it that way has therapeutic benefits? So we've got a research grant from the Defense Department, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and studied the use in traumatic brain injury, which is very similar in some ways in terms of ischemia reperfusion injury to the kinds of things you see with stroke, because there's this swelling that decreases the ability of the blood flow to perfuse through the brain because the skull is a undeformable box, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get blood through the brain, there has to be a higher pressure in the arteries that drive the blood into the tissue than the back pressure pushing back against it. It's a plumbing problem. And in the skull, which is rigid, if there's too much swelling, the blood can't flow into the brain. So traumatic brain injury, therefore, can also have ischemia reperfusion injury. So we tried using near-infrared light in this situation, and we were able to successfully demonstrate significant benefits for traumatic brain injury in our experimental model. And the next step, among other things, will be to try to develop new technology to do this in humans and then test it and see how deep we can get the treatment. Can we get it as deep as the near-infrared spectroscopy devices that are already used for diagnosis? Well, I feel pretty strongly we can, because that's already being done routinely in clinical intensive care settings. Can we get it even deeper so that we could treat the deeper parts of the brain?
Sure.
We had a National Institutes of Health grant to study Parkinson's disease, and we were able to demonstrate benefits in genetically engineered mice that had inborn problems with their ability to manage oxidative stress. And Alzheimer's disease is also a problem in the brain that's actually due to the abnormality in cytochrome oxidase itself interfering with the ability of neurons or brain cells to manage oxidative stress. And in the eye, the disease age-related macular degeneration starts off as a problem with degenerating the brain, brain-like cells, the retinal cells, the neurons that actually pick up the visual impulses to send them to your brain so you can see something from the light that comes in through your eyes and lenses and everything. So age-related macular degeneration has this so-called dry form, the early stage, where you start to lose retinal cells through to degeneration due to oxidative stress, burning themselves to death like an old newspaper turns yellow. Then later on, there's another stage that's hemorrhagic, and that's called the wet form. We want to treat before that, before you lose the vision. We don't want to wait until you've already lost vision like the current treatments do. So that's an easy one to get light into because the eye has been designed to let light in. But some of these other things, we want to engineer devices that can aim the light beams from different directions that sort of meet in the middle and converge so we can focus the light deeper into the brain. And we're trying to study the chemistry of how the light interacts with cytochrome oxidase to take better advantage of the way that we can administer the light to make it more effective deeper into body tissues. So those are some of the newer things we're trying to do.
We hope you enjoyed this free excerpt from today's program. Register to become a sponsoring member so you can hear the complete interview for any of the radio shows in our library. Just click the sidebar link and select your membership level. It's that easy.